This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Coquitlam peoples.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicos. Today is June 3rd, 2021, and this is episode 242.
I'm Scott DeLindeboom.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, reconciliation, as it's in the news, residential schools, forestry, Ferry Creek, everything you would expect based on the headlines. First, thank you to the 101 people who contribute to the podcast every month. You can join them at patreon.com/politicos. But this week, I want to encourage you to take a minute and share the show, to mention it to a friend, to promote us on social media, to help get the word out. Our listenership is solid. We have a great number of listeners. It's great that you check us out every month, but it could be more. I bet there are more people who would find us interesting. If you know someone who you think needs to hear two dudes talk about BC politics and occasionally have some guests, tell them to visit us at politicos.ca. Get at us.
Yeah, or if you're a regular listener and want to continue the conversation, not just listen to us, but bounce ideas and discuss politics with like-minded British Columbians, please become a patron and get access to our Slack.
Patreon.com/Politicos. Politicos is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicos, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to politicstoday.news/free-trial. Well, let's jump into the first segment. No pithy title. We're going to talk about the terrible news out of Kamloops, out of the residential school there. Before we begin, we should, of course, encourage anyone who's listening, who needs to take the time to find the support they need. The best resource that everyone seems to be promoting is the Indian Residential School Survivor Society. You can call them toll-free at 1-800-721-0066 or their 24-hour national crisis line at 1-866-925-4419. And if you don't need them, I do encourage you to consider donating to them at irsss.ca. Alternatively, I know that the Tikemlups people are looking for donations to help support further work in their community to find these bodies, these children. And you can visit their website at tkemlups.ca, and you can find out how to support their work and their ongoing work. And we'll throw those links in the show notes. But I talked about this a bit with Matthew on Canby Report, just because it's such heavy news. But what was your reaction, Scott, to the news?
This is one of those situations where it's not surprising, but nevertheless a bit stark to have it come out. It's not exactly been a secret that the residential schools had unconscionably high mortality rates. So in that respect, this seems to more or less just be a confirmation of that. Nevertheless, there's no way a mass grave is, particularly an unmarked one, isn't shocking.
Yeah, that was what I was thinking and feeling. And like I said, I didn't necessarily react strongly right away. But as you think about what this implies, what it has meant, it's terrible. It's tragic. Children as young as three. My child's just under two. And so I can't imagine being one of those parents. And those parents weren't told necessarily that their kids just didn't come home from school, which feels like it's like the bare minimum to expect, especially when your kids are being torn from your household in many cases. So like you say, this wasn't unexpected. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission report, which came out, I think, 7 years ago now, told us about this. There are reports in there that it references, and the Taiz covered this as well, from the 30s, from the 40s, from the 50s of various people, inspectors, writing reports to Parliament saying, writing reports to the Department of Indian Affairs saying, these places are bad, they're not being run well, they're underfunded, children are dying at absurd rates of tuberculosis, of preventable diseases. Please save their lives, give them more money, give them food, they're starving. And we didn't do it. So it's a tough situation to discuss, especially as settlers. It's what can we take away? What can we do with this now? The calls to action are starting to come from the various nations who are processing this, and it's a slow process to try to come to terms with this news. The Office of the Chief of the... I'm going to apologize again for my mispronunciations as always, but the Tecumloops Tsekwemec people have asked to be respectful of their cultural protocols and take their lead on it to ensure that there's not a tragedy upon tragedy by upholding the public health orders. So don't go visit them. Don't go violating health orders and get your vaccines, of course. They're encouraging everyone to review the TRC's final report. It's 400 plus pages. It's pretty heavy read, but it is a very thorough documentation, and it's pretty readable of what happened, readable other than the atrocities. And at very least, the calls to action are pretty straightforward to look at what governments, organizations, media, and churches should be doing. And thankfully, most churches have made their apologies or made some steps to reconcile, but the Catholic Church has notably been the laggard on that, which is relevant here because this was a Catholic residential school.
Yeah, and they were very involved in the program. And it's not the entire Catholic organization has taken such a strong, or not even strong, gone the silent route on this. The local Archbishop for Vancouver's been fairly forward on coming out with an apology, but it's not the whole Catholic Church. It's just the local diocese or archdiocese. I don't know. I don't know my Catholic org chart.
It's the Vancouver Archdiocese issued an apology, which was really good to see. But yeah, the Vatican has refused any responsibility. They say this is the time when Catholicism is not actually a super hierarchical. It was like the local branch just happened to go that way and do these bad things in collaboration, of course, and under the guidance of the Government of Canada. So there's lots more for all of these groups to do, and people who are Catholic, I've seen a number speaking out and putting pressure on their church, which is great to see. Every Canadian can, of course, ask both our provincial and federal governments what they are doing. It was good to see that this work was funded by the province of BC. It's a bit frustrating because this was a call to action of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission for the federal government to fund this kind of research. And it seems like they haven't done it despite Trudeau promising 5 years ago to implement every recommendation.
It wasn't a huge amount of money either. What was that, like $1.3 million or something for the proposed search?
Yeah, I think, and that's even for all of the schools.
Which is couch cushion money for the federal government. It's a rounding error on one department's budget.
The lack of willingness to take action has been, I think, the most clearest result of this news. Is you can't hide behind good words anymore following this. This, I think, is starting to get framed as like a watershed change moment. Maybe it will be, hopefully. Maybe this is the punch of the truth, and now we can really start working on reconciliation. Of course, we do need to dig to discover more truth. There is a lot of pain and suffering that is still unanswered. People have brought up the fact the federal government is still in court defending the right to keep records from some of these schools under lock and key and ideally be destroyed in the government's view, versus survivors would like to see those records from the schools, which seems reasonable. especially if they're your family members or it was
pure
life?
Seeing the record seems reasonable. The federal government is very much unreasonable in that, as far as I can tell.
So, fighting survivors in court looks bad. Saying you're going to do more, but then not following through, seeing bad. This did manage to seemingly push the federal government to finally release the national action plan it had been working on for the missing, murdered Indigenous and women and girls inquiry, something that was promised following the release of that report in 2019. It wasn't met with a great reaction. So the report itself is a 30-page document called Federal Pathway that tries to figure out what the federal government can and should do to respond to. I think there were 200 calls to action in that inquiry. There's a number of promises around improving and preserving Indigenous cultures and languages, implementing the Indigenous Languages Act.
Which was also part of the 94 calls of the TRC. So there seems to be a certain amount of redundancy on that. And the federal government's line was that they'd were in the process or had completed the majority of the stuff, but I believe when CBC looked into it, it was something like 10 completions and another 30 or so underway.
Yeah, and many of the calls to action in the TRC's report echoed the Royal Commission on Aboriginal People, which was done in 1991 and reported in 1996. It followed the Oka crisis and the failure of the Meech Lake Accord, and it had a 20-year agenda for implementing changes, and it largely got put on a shelf despite a lot of significant changes that could have really transformed the relationship between Canada and Indigenous peoples.
Yeah, you'd ask if this time is different, and it is things like that that make me a little skeptical it really will be. This has definitely grabbed the national attention, but the reality to date has been that these issues tend to grab everyone's attention and then fade after a couple of weeks, and it's going to be an open question whether that's different this time or not.
Yeah, on the national action plan that was released today, Trudeau argues that there was $2.2 billion in the recent budget that is attached to items that are in here, but the plan put out today didn't include specifics in terms of dollar figures, budgets, timelines. It's a very, the Canadian press describes it as a general in nature, and the government's excuse is that they want to co-develop the actions. So I don't know exactly what they've been doing for the past 2 years on this. Like, granted, COVID would have slowed work down on a project like this, as it did across government departments, but consultations would have had to have been underway if they were serious about this. Instead, it feels like the thing that someone went, oh yeah, we were working on that, we should just push that out this week and not do it on Friday, because Friday would be bad. It would look like we're trying to bury it. But we've been doing something. We have a response to this national tragedy and thing people are paying attention to finally.
And even the pandemic, it may have slowed things down a bit. The city of Vancouver can consult on something as minor as zoning tweaks. I'm sure the federal government, with all its resources, can find a way to do virtual consultations.
I don't know if Vancouver is the best example to use in terms of getting things done.
That is a good point, but it's also the level of consultations I'm most familiar with, and the only one I've participated in virtually during the pandemic.
Yeah, and like the provincial government has been working with the Huitzilopochtli people on developing their governance structure through the pandemic, and some of that work has continued and seems like it's made progress. So this national action plan, for example, has already been panned by the Union of BC Indian Chiefs, who described it as not a national action plan. This is in their title. They call it, or say it will not end the genocide of Indigenous women and girls, and are just utterly disappointed by the lack of specificity in it, which, again, like, you've had 2 years, you can get some stuff done. It has been interesting, I've noticed as well, to see the specifics of how different parties, political actors have been responding. It seems like this is one of the rare times when across the political spectrum, there is a consensus that things need to be done. Like we saw Jason Kenney and Scott Moe put money towards further research projects like this in their own provinces to look into the sites of residential schools in those provinces. Again, things the federal government could and should have been doing, but conservative premiers are willing to step up for that, which is a good sign. I'll give full credit to them for that. I believe BC is also putting some more money towards it. Like across the political spectrum at the provincial level, you're seeing action. And we've seen a debate in the federal House of Commons, I believe, but still getting towards specifics.
Yeah, this is one of those things that there's no real ideal any part of the Canadian political spectrum, with the, I don't know, possible obsession of whatever Bernier's off doing at the moment, so I hope we didn't forget about him soon, that is has any ideological opposition to moving forward with this stuff. Doesn't always take the same shape, but there is no major party that is opposed. They just haven't always put much emphasis on actually doing the work. And to get kind of crassly political about it, this is one of those unfortunate things where it's hard. It's a tough area. It's hard to make progress on. And parties tend not to get rewarded at the ballot box when they do. It's been real easy for politicians to date to just not necessarily oppose doing things, but never quite have it as a priority, even if they aren't in theory against it.
The charitable way to look at it is the government's really good at half-assing it because there's always something more profitable, more valuable to their voting constituents than funding clean drinking water and things that are important and necessary to keep people living. But the less, you know, charitable way is that those people, those Indigenous communities are just valued less by our political system. Will things change? There's the optimistic side of me that is hopeful this is an inflection point, that enough has been building over the recent years. We've had two significant inquiries in the last decade and a half that have really changed the conversation in many ways. And now just the question is, can that continue? Can that momentum continue? Or will the long momentum of at best doing very little, at worst actively undermining Indigenous sovereignty and lives and dignity? History is on that side, unfortunately.
This is something I just have no real way of prognosticating on, and I'm not even going to try, because it would literally just be trying to guess for all the complicated reasons we've touched on till this point.
Well, I think the last thing I'll mention is, off the top, I mentioned doing some further reading as a listener. The TRC report is a great place to start. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission also released a supplemental report by Dr. Scott Hamilton of the Department of Anthropology at Lakehead University titled Where Are the Children Buried? And this came out just following the news out of Kamloops. And we've not had the time to go deep through this report, but it's an interesting and unfortunately morbid report that looks at where are the bodies and what has happened to those children who didn't make it home from these schools, because there are documented deaths, but there aren't necessarily documented graves for all of these children. And then there's also undocumented deaths, numbers that don't add up. And so this looks at some of the policies, some of the issues that have led to the situation we're in, a mix of underfunding, government callousness, and so forth, that have led to situations like Kamloops, where you get mass graves and an inability to do the basic dignity that is deserved when a child or anyone dies, which is to give them the memorial that is appropriate to their culture, and at least notify their family. And, you know, this report looks into some of that and gives some further thoughts and suggestions about where to go from here. So, useful reading there. But again, pretty dark stuff. This is a big part of our country's history and present. And yeah, every Canadian has a duty to be aware of the reality that we live in.
Yeah, agreed. So I'm actually curious about you grew up in Alberta and went to school. Did they teach anything about this
there? They actually did. So I graduated high school in 2004. So I would have been in social studies between 2002 and 2004. And I had a pretty lefty social studies teacher as far as I could tell, but I can't remember if she was going off curriculum or not. I would have no way of knowing that. But we did talk in our review of Canadian history, I forget what grade that was, about residential schools. It wasn't super in-depth as anything was in high school, but it was not presented as a positive thing. I think that has varied from a lot of people I've heard. I know schools are working hard to incorporate more since even that time, but that was my experience.
Yeah, I graduated high school in 2008 in BC, and it was taught, and I honestly can't quite recall what as a teenager I knew from being taught it in school versus just picking it up. Because there was a big, I think it was the residential schools apology. There was some big news event around that time too related to this, but definitely something I was cognizant of at the time. And I think a decent amount of that had to do with what was covered in school. And there was an Indigenous history portion of, I want to say grade 9 social studies curriculum that touched on it.
Yeah, it definitely wasn't that early for me. One of the weird things about Southern Alberta, and I looked into this a couple years ago when I went back to Stampede, is it's a multifaceted history of engagement between settlers and Indigenous peoples. A lot of it is residential schools, dark, genocidal approaching, but other elements of it were frankly positive. The Stampede itself, for example, the history of it has always included an Indian village, which is now being renamed, I believe. But the start of that was Guy Wiedek, who founded Stampede, wanted to make sure that the local bands of Treaty 7, I believe it is, were included in this celebration in like the 1920s. And at that time, the federal government's policy was not a celebration of Indigenous culture, but of assimilation. And Guy Wiedek actually fought the federal government to make sure that the local chiefs could be involved in the front of the parade. And he created the Indian village as a way for members of those nations to come and be part of the celebration and also share their culture with visitors, which is like not what I expected the history of the Stampede to be. It was not exploitative at all. In fact, it was a very collaborative thing. And I think that element of history is there in parts of like local communities, the people, like some of the people who came and lived and tried to farm and work the land weren't necessarily the perpetrators of the violence of the RCMP, of the Northwest Mounted Police, of the state of Canada. They were just people who had escaped famines in Ireland or Ukraine and heard there was good land up for sale in Canada for cheap, which of course was stolen land or taken on fairly unfair treaties. But there was no desire among many of those people to persecute their neighbors as they saw them. Now, I'm not saying it was blissful. I'm sure there was a lot of racism in the past, and you can still find a lot of racist jokes against Indigenous people in Southern Alberta when you go talk into the right circles. But there are elements of our history that I think are also good. And those are the things that I think we can... I'm not trying to play the there were good parts of residential school card in any way. The purpose of the state was genocidal. It was to eradicate a culture. But there were elements that we can try and draw from that I think we can take valuable lessons, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think I know what you're saying. So after graduating high school, I spent several years in Eastern Canada, and something that was quite striking to me is just how much less visible kind of Indigenous cultures are in Ontario and New Brunswick and just the East in general. British Columbia, you just see a lot more of it. I think it's just more part of, it's not really the pattern, but like you see a lot more, say, Indigenous art just around the city and around places here. And it's much more woven in than in a lot of other parts of Canada.
That's an interesting observation.
Yeah, BC, I think, just has some different... The history there is a bit different than other parts of Canada. Some of it is pretty bad. Like, most of the provinces has no treaties covering it. But yeah, it does manifest in other ways. And I think there is a little more of that kind of intercultural back and forth here compared to other parts of Canada.
There is the stories of the Chinook language, which was the mixing of English, French, and various Indigenous terms to create a kind of trader's language, where the first settlers to come to these areas could communicate with local Indigenous peoples. And those kind of things are fun little bits of history, I find. But I wonder, like, when you look across a map of residential schools across Canada, the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation, nctr.ca's website, most of the schools were across Manitoba and Alberta, the west there, many in BC. There were some in Ontario and Quebec, but far fewer. So I think that part of the history gets less focus out east, as well as just the heavy immigration during the early colonial periods to Quebec and Ontario meant those nations got pushed to reserves much quicker. And BC also has a great diversity of nations. Like, it has more languages and different nations than anywhere else in Canada, just through the unique combinations of history. Like, the territories of the Plains tribes across Alberta and Saskatchewan were quite vast, versus you have 2, 3, 4 nations not competing but sharing territories and lands in much of Metro Van, even where you have very fertile land. I wonder if there's different elements to it there that also contribute to how things are celebrated and recognized. Then again, many of the nations of Ontario and Quebec, the Iroquois and the Huron and many of these peoples, had very complex societies as well. Not to say they didn't in BC, but I do remember learning in school about the Iroquois Federacy, for example, and some of the democracies that had been set up in the matriarchal democracies, which was fascinating stuff.
Just circling back a bit after this slight diversion or tangent a bit. Yeah, this has been a pretty jarring week for a lot of Canada, and we're just going to have to continue to work through this, and it's probably not going to be easy. Moving on to our second segment, there's a new forestry policy, or intention to put out a forestry policy, I should actually say, that was released this Tuesday by the provincial government. This doesn't actually change things, but kind of lays out where the BC government wants to take things.
This feels a lot in many ways like the federal government's response to the missing, murdered Indigenous women and girls inquiry that I mentioned off the first segment, where there's something big in the news and the government feels they need to put something out to respond to it, but they're not ready with their final product yet. So here's a starting place, which is a lot of things will happen in the vague future. And none of the things are bad, but they're not defined or really solved yet. And so it's like, all right, I get you're responding to the events, but does this help? I guess it shows you're doing some work on the file. And I think this is a little bit more substantive. of work than maybe what the federal government is doing, or maybe I'm just super cynical about the federal Liberals doing anything on reconciliation or anything versus the BC government. But we have an intentions paper, which I'm not even really sure. I guess it's an intention to have a real paper.
So forestry is one of those policy areas that I have to admit I don't know a huge amount. So reading through here, it was pretty hard as someone who isn't very familiar with kind of the existing forestry rules and all that to figure out exactly what the actual changes were going to be. Technical tweaks or intentions to change up some of the technical processes and like allocations of forest tenures, but it's hard to actually like get a good sense of just random person in a city who knows that we have a logging industry and that's an important part of the economy, but like doesn't really actually know the ins and outs of all that policy.
Yeah, I'm largely in the same boat, which makes this not the most helpful conversation probably for you as a listener, and we're going to get flack from listeners who are like, you should just invite someone who knows what they're talking about on. And you're right, I just really wish I had the time. But hopefully for next week or one of our quieter weeks coming up, and if you know someone who knows their forestry policy inside and out, send them our way. Our DMs are open. Like, the problems are pretty well understood in that our province has a finite amount of old growth forests, these forests that generally have trees over 250 years old that are large, biodiverse sinks and valuable for both the ecosystem and their rarity. They're good for the climate and they're good for nature, and they're largely classified as a non-renewable resource. They're like, trees grow back, but they don't grow back 250 years old overnight. Obviously, chopping down 250, 300, 500, 1,000 year old trees drives a stake through many people's hearts, mine included, because it's quite a hard thing to recover from. It's kind of, and so there's an extra emotional attachment to it that oil and gas extraction, which is also a non-renewable resource, doesn't necessarily have in the same way. So I get why people are so motivated to go out to Ferry Creek or to any of these protests. Like, I understand it, and it's a powerful thing in that way. And there's this added complication where the government talks about how much of the old growth forest is left, and there's different ways to measure it. And so you have this estimates from the Sierra Club and many environmentalists saying many of the things classified by the government as old growth forests are possibly not fairly categorized that way because the trees may not be the most diverse, or those are unlikely to be as... There's differences in the definition, and it matters because if in some of the worst case scenario estimates, we have 10 years of logging at the current rate before we run out of old growth forests, and that would be bad. And so if the plan of the government to save our old growth forests isn't going to last, or it isn't going to come into place for 2 or 3 years, we could lose a lot of forestry in that time.
But this also isn't entirely about the old growth forest. It's more of a general forestry policy, I believe, rather than just focusing on the admittedly pretty small proportion that is the old growth forest. And it's also worth remembering that the forestry sector is a pretty significant part of the economy. It's not quite to us what oil is to Alberta, but it's not insignificant either. There are a lot of places in the province that forestry is the primary source of jobs, and it's the thing that drives the economy in a lot of BC.
Estimated about $9.7 billion worth of wood products are exported from BC, and $4.4 billion in pulp and paper, and that's just in 2017. A lot of it does go to export. There's only so many trees around the world, and we have lots, so it's unsurprising. It's a significant amount of funding. And for communities like those small logging communities along Vancouver Island or in the interior, there's not a clear transition, right? You can't just switch from forestry to tourism. And you could do a bit of tourism, but not every community could.
Yeah,
and we also do need the product, right?
Yeah, my family, part of it's from Port Alberni, and like that's a town that's basically there because there was a sawmill and a pulp mill there, and it's also a decent port. But that really was the driver of the economy for a long time. And I don't think it's as big a part of the economy there as it used to be, but like, it's not insignificant. There are a lot of people who make their living there logging, and when the forestry industry is in trouble, the town feels it.
And so I think the point of this intentions paper is to really redraft what our approach is to forestry in broad strokes, both protecting the old growth forests, but also ensuring those communities have long-term stability. So the changes to the broad changes it proposes to putting at the center of our future forestry policy is sustainability, reconciliation, people and communities, competitiveness, and fairness for British Columbians, which are all smiley, nice, happy-sounding things. Some of them seem like they might put one another in tension at times, and it's unclear how you balance those, which I guess is the ongoing discussion of this paper.
Yeah, that's almost always the case when it comes to policy. There is no government that, you know, puts in their press releases or policy goals, opposition to sustainability or unsustainability as a goal. It's always something governments are looking at, particularly at the, you know, probably political levels of the civil service when they're drafting these things. But it's always when the trade-off comes in. And I think we have a good example of where those things are in tension right now with the Ferry Creek issues. Like, it's not always easy to have a, or it's the case where you can put all this stuff in a nice paper, but when push comes to shove, sometimes you have to make decisions on what gets a priority, and it's not necessarily clear in here how that shapes out.
Thankfully, there are some specifics in here, or at least clear directions the government is going to go. In their three principles they want to look at, they talk about increasing forestry sector participation. And specifically, that looks like it's going to translate to buying out a number of the tenures, the rights to forest that a lot of the large companies have, the Teal Joneses of the world, and transferring those tenures to either local companies or in many cases to First Nations to operate on their own, which I think it fits with the government's goal of reconciliation. If you're going to say the responsibility for logging Ferry Creek will be in the hands of the Pachitat Nation rather than in the hands of Teal Jones. And even if Teal Jones still ends up getting the contract to cut the trees with the local nation, the money goes directly through them rather than the circuitous route it's going right now. In either way, they're still getting jobs and money, but there's a sovereignty approach to that.
The bit about the small companies I think I'm less thrilled about. Politicians love to talk about small businesses and whatnot, but in theory, the thing we want is to have our small businesses become large businesses, and I don't know why that wouldn't also be the case in the forestry sector. And the corollary to that is, does it make sense to then try and turn big businesses into small businesses?
I think there's always the balance they're going for. You can have an issue where you end up with oligopoly and monopolization of a sector, and trying to break that up a bit can encourage a bit more competition in the free market sense. I don't know how bad it is in the forestry sector. I've heard that there's only 4 or 5 players, which sounds like every sector in Canada. And honestly, most sectors in Canada could use a little more pushing to break up some of the big boys. I think it's probably promising here, but again, find us an expert. The second principle they're going to go for is enhancing stewardship and sustainability. And here it looks like they're going to actually start using... Oh, sorry, that's the next one. Enhancing stewardship and sustainability. Here, a lot of it seems to be based around ensuring that Indigenous practices and wisdom is brought into many of the management philosophies, for example, for cultural fire, for example, forestry management that takes into consideration how to prevent ongoing forest fires, which will be a continuing measure of a continuing important thing to consider in our future, as well as just making sure that we are improving upon the acts we're working on. Again, here, not doing a great job. Let's get into the last one, though, strengthening the social contract. Here, I found an interesting point where they want tenure holders to need to demonstrate a clear commitment to sustainability. That suggests that if your company is clear-cutting old growth forests, you won't get to keep your tenure and you will lose the right to continue to cut down trees, which seems like a way to try to really heavily nudge the market in the way you want to see it go. They'll also be promoting. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, yes. This is once again where my lack of knowledge may be holding me back. And like I said, people suggest us and that's trying to get them on, but to be like a defined area that they cannot be allowed to log, right? Like it's got to be geographically constrained. So, like if you have a tenure and it's over an area of old growth as opposed to no new growth, like it's not either the thing probably gets more or less rendered worthless as an economic item because you can't then log it, or their definition of sustainability is sufficiently loose that you can do at least some logging in those areas.
And you can also have second and newer growth forestry practices that are more and less sustainable, like clear cutting wide swaths of land, even if it's not an old growth forest, is generally not a sustainable practice. Forests have a natural cycle and you need to make sure you're replanting at a rate that the trees can grow back within a reasonable number of years and you haven't just emptied the ecosystem, essentially. So there's approaches there that I think can be encouraged that protect newer growth forests as well. The other elements of the social contract section that are interesting to me are the idea of increasing local value-added manufacturers and I guess with that, promoting the use of wooden mass timber in construction. And so we would see a whole life cycle of the tree go from cutting it down to churning it into building construction materials here in province and putting it up into new homes in Vancouver, hopefully, and elsewhere across the province, and creating jobs all along the way.
Yeah, the mass timber industry is something that's a really exciting growth area and quite interesting building technology that does have a huge amount of potential, both economically and just as a general way to improve our city and home building. So yeah, so really excited to see how that continues to develop.
Yeah, so that's like the quick read of what we saw in the plan. Part of the government's reasoning for not going farther faster with this, or even with Fairy Creek, for example, is their statement that they're working on the first recommendation of the Old Growth Strategic Review, which is to engage the full involvement of Indigenous leaders and organizations to review the report and work with the province on any subsequent policy or strategy development and implementation. In other words, they don't want to just run roughshod over Indigenous peoples. They do actually want to build the relationships and do the consultations and the work to make sure the policies being rolled out are consistent up and supported up and down and across the province by everyone who is affected by it and is a title holder in it. The Premier put it maybe a bit crassly this week when he said implementing all the recommendations means that we have to implement all of the recommendations, and the critical recommendation that's at play at Fairy Creek is consulting with the title holders, the people whose land where the forest is growing on. He said if we were to arbitrarily put deferrals in place there, that would be return to the colonialism that we have so graphically been brought back to as a result of the issues in Kamloops this week, I'm not prepared to do that. In other words, to just tell the Pachidat and Huayat First Nations that you can't log anymore, even if he just gave them a check, would be to basically say, we're still the grown-up government that gets to decide what happens. Here's a check. Stop making noise. When those nations, as far as the government can tell from its interactions with the elected chief and who has presented himself, as far as for the longest time, as the hereditary chief, Frank Keystone Jones, these nations have said they want the logging to continue when they don't want the protesters there. It gets more conflicted as other members of the council are starting to speak up, and another person, Bill Jones, has come forward to say he is the real hereditary chief, and they do want the protesters there, and they want the logging to stop. But the government does have to listen to the nation as it understands the leadership, and not just in a, oh, this is the convenient leadership for them. But as far as I think they can tell, it's voices that have been the leaders in the past.
It's one of these areas that I think we're going to see continual tensions in and political controversies going forward on this. This is probably just a taste of Tom what's happening in Fairy Creek now, particularly as environmental concerns take up an ever larger part of our politics. For all the reasons he said, it's definitely important to consult and talk to the First Nations. And there are a lot of First Nations in various parts of BC and Canada in general that are in areas that you're not likely to get just a lot of economic and other kind of prosperity-enhancing developments in there, just because they are very remote, and the modern economy is very much driven by people rather than, say, raw manufacturing capacity in a lot of ways, or, you know, other sorts of things. And that really just does leave resource development for the economic development of a huge part of the province, because the service industry that we have in Vancouver just isn't something you can easily transport to the smaller communities, say, up the coast. And as a result, I think you're going to see Indigenous groups take an increasingly large role in the economic development and resource development of the province. And that Ellis Ross, who's running for the BC Liberal leadership, is, you know, this is one of his big things. And it's something I think you're going to see a lot more Indigenous leaders also take up. And that is going to put them in conflict with a lot of environmentalists. And it's not like the environmentalists don't have a point either. We kind of touched a bit on this in last week's episode, but like, it's also not the case that local groups of pretty much any culture can make bad and or unsustainable decisions when it comes to resource use in their areas, and ones that have negative spillovers into other ones. And there then becomes a role for the province in that. Like, it's just a mess of competing issues that all have importance, and it's going to be tough going forward to sort those out. And you're going to see just, I think, a lot of that continue to arise as a tension point.
Even here in Metro Van, you have the Squamish Nation very connected to the Woodfibre LNG project that's going to start construction this fall. It's been delayed by COVID, it looks like, everything's been delayed by COVID. But that's a fascinating project that I'm actually surprised it hasn't gotten more attention, positive or negative. I think it's gotten a reasonable amount of positive, but for a LNG project that's going in Vancouver's backyard up in Squamish, fewer people are critical of it than I would have expected. But maybe that'll start this fall, and then they'll have to work that out with the Squamish Nation. We'll throw a couple more links of things to read in the show notes. The only other thing that I didn't touch on last week on some of the protests up at Fairy Creek, and perhaps it's gotten better, and Canada Land did a good piece last week on this, is there was a raft of stories again where you had a situation where the RCMP are enforcing an injunction, which is their job. And in that process, they come into conflict with members of the media, legal observers who are there doing their jobs and upholding their constitutional rights to give us a free press and to ensure people have the legal representation they need. And a lot of the initial stories of the RCMP's behavior were really not promising, especially from smaller media outlets who represent podcasts and newsletters and websites that don't have a 100-year history but are doing groundbreaking work. And media representatives were being questioned in ways that are inappropriate for the RCMP to ask, like asking for press approval credentials, which is not really a thing. Like, you can actually just call yourself a journalist in this country. And as there is like a legal test of what is journalism, but it's not like we have a, oh, if you're not a member of the Press Council of Canada, you're not a real journalist. If you're doing journalism, like you're being a fair, balanced reporter, you have a right to go and watch newsworthy public interest events. And for the RCMP to use the cover of being hours outside of cell range to, as far as I know, they didn't mistreat, like abuse or touch any media, thankfully, but they did turn many people away from protests so that observers couldn't be there. Thankfully, a few more have gotten through and have managed to come back with stories so we can see what's happening and know the stories. And we'll throw a link to a really good long-form piece that was published in the TAI by Arno Kopecky and some of the other stories. But man, the RCMP loves to just abuse its power when they think they can get away with it. So we'll close it off here. We touched on a lot and probably didn't do anything the justice it deserves. A lot of this stuff is stuff we're learning about and continuing to learn about. We've never pretended to be experts on anything in particular. We're two guys who started a podcast because we like politics, and a lot of the time it's fun and interesting stuff, or even just wild, unexpected, like wood splitters being bought by the legislature and ridiculous scandals, because this country is so often ridiculous, but this country is so often also dark and has a history that needs to be fully appreciated. I think we are seeing efforts to change that. There is some reason for promising, optimism, I think, within this old growth strategy and some of the intentions being put out by the BC government. Of course, I totally get why so many Indigenous people and so many activists are very skeptical and very cynical. Canada doesn't have a great history at any of this, and promises are more often broken than keep the pressure up. Change can happen. That's what I'm going to leave it with.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Politicoast is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Wash your hands and stay home. Thanks for listening.